702. Let's walk the talk.
Streaming countrywide on the 702 app.
It is 13 minutes past 9 o'clock, as I said. Up next, a very important conversation. It's Africa at a Glance. And joining us on the line is Dr. Abdul Algoni from the Sudan Solidarity Group. Good evening to you, Doctor. Good evening, and thank you for joining us.
Good evening, and thank you very much for giving Sudan time in the media. Thank you very much.
No, it's extremely important. I don't know how much you heard, Doctor, prior to obviously putting you on air. But as I said not too long ago, we saw a split in what used to be Africa's largest country, being Sudan into Sudan as well as South Sudan. And I guess that this was done. It was unprecedented. It was something that the world doesn't like to see, where countries are split into two. But it was done for the purpose of peace, considering that Sudan needed peace for quite some time. And lo and behold, there's no peace in either one of the two countries.
Yes, I agree with you. Actually, first, I wanted to say one thing, is that both Sudanese and South Sudanese are one nation living in two countries. This is one thing. The other thing, we agreed that for the two peoples to divide South Sudan for the sake of peace. But unfortunately, when South Sudan went alone, the number of people who died in 2 years were more than the people who have died in 20 years. So we are still hungry for peace, and we didn't find it. But what is happening in North Sudan now, for me, it is a real revolution. It is a real change of purpose, change of mentality, change of vision among the majority of the youth in Sudan. I have been to Sudan twice or three times since 2018. And I have found that Sudan has transformed, actually, completely transformed. People have seen themselves lying in the desert of the Sahara Desert, and dying in the Mediterranean, and there is no light at the end of the tunnel. And this has put energy in them to change their lives and the way the country is governed. And they said the military are the ones who have brought it into this for 30 years. And there is a new atmosphere now in Sudan, and I believe the change in northern Sudan might also sweep South Sudan and bring at least a light at the end of the tunnel.
So let's look at what, prior to sort of these new developments and the positivity that you're sharing about what the future for Sudan holds. The question is, what were some of the issues post the split between Sudan as well as South Sudan? What were some of the issues in Sudan in particular that still led to conflict and still led to instability in the country?
I will bring you first the conspiracy theory. It has been said that there were meetings outside Sudan where generals from Israel and from America have spoken of dividing Sudan into five countries.
Okay.
South Sudan, this was something that was said in the 90s.
Mm-hmm.
They want to divide Sudan into five countries: South Sudan, Western Sudan, Eastern Sudan, Central Sudan, and Northern Sudan.
Mm-hmm.
And that they will start with South Sudan, and then they will go into Darfur, Western Sudan. And this has been talked about for a very long time, and we have seen South Sudan seceding, and we did not resist it. Seeing our brothers wanted to be alone, we said, okay, let us have peace. So this is one piece of the discussion that I wanted to put here. But the other thing is that, you see, there is a lot of economic problems. The military rule is not good for Sudan. Darfur has become a a media jargon for almost 10 years because of the atrocities that has happened in Darfur, and the name of the Janjaweed is known everywhere. So practically, there was a very bad leadership for the country.
Mm.
And this bad leadership has made every Sudanese a politician. People, instead of talking about education, about development, about this, they speak about how can we change this bad situation to a better. And all the youth didn't find any job, so they went with the military, the rebel movement. And this has created an atmosphere that is not conducive for development, and but actually it is inviting for war and separation, and then the previous government to stay in power, it added in the tribal component into politics, pushing one tribe against the other in divide and rule. So there are a lot of complex reasons. I can put them as economic, as social, as tribal, as just egoistic issues. So complex that kept Sudan in the media for the bad reasons for the last 30 years of al-Bashir rule in Sudan.
And that's quite tragic. You know, prior to this, obviously the people of Sudan were subject to the governance, the rule, the whatever you want to call it, of Omar al-Bashir. And, you know, you know, by far and large seen as an international criminal. Unfortunately, the African Union, you know, seemed to have sheltered him, and you know, South Africa itself played its role there, where you know, the ICC issued a warrant for his arrest when he was here in South Africa, and instead of, you know, dealing with the issue appropriately as we should have, we basically assisted him in going back to Sudan. You know, the man is responsible for some of the worst atrocities on the continent in recent history. What is his current fate? What is his current situation? Because following the coup, or following, you know, the takeover in Sudan, the question is, you know, subsequent to that, what is his fate? Is this someone, a lot of people were saying that he was going to die pretty soon. A lot of people said that he was going to get the justice that he deserves. What was his eventual fate?
You see, our revolution government have decided to take him and the other four that were indicted by the ICC to the Hague. To be judged at the Hague. But things didn't work right and the coup now. And we heard in the grapevine that the leader of the military coup has taken him out of prison, and he is now in the state, what is it called? It's the state house, with the general who did the coup, and he is no longer in prison. This is what we heard in the grapevine, because you see, none of us can go into covert prison where he has been staying all this time to see if he is there or not. But anyway. He is in prison for to spend the term that was given to him for money laundering and issues like this. But there are other issues that he will be taken to court for that will keep him the rest of his life in prison. But it didn't happen because this coup came in between, and we are just hoping that today there were a million citizen marches all over Sudan. We believe they might change the future and bring our revolution government back, especially now our prime minister is back in office. So if things went well, I think he will spend the rest of his life in jail, at least paying part of the suffering that he has made for millions of Sudanese all over, including myself. By the way, I spent 5-7 months in security jails, including ghost housing, including prisons, including security jails. And I don't think there is a house in Sudan who has not suffered one way or the other from al-Bashir's regime. So at least it's staying in prison. He's just paying a small component of the suffering that he has made to his people, yes.
I mean, what gave the people the impetus, the power, the courage to be able to stand up to Omar al-Bashir, considering that, I mean, this is someone that faces some of the most serious allegations you've mentioned, money laundering and corruption and those types of things, which is one side of the coin. But, I mean, from a human rights perspective, I mean, this is someone that carpet bombed his own people. You know, some would even argue that this is someone that was conducting acts of genocide, if not genocide itself. So the key question for me really is, what gave people the courage to finally stand up to him and to take a stand to the point whereby we have a coup and a change in leadership that happened in Sudan?
If I'm responding to that, there are three things. One of them is the Sudanese personality itself.
Mm-hmm.
The Sudanese are not Arabs, are not Africans. They are a mixture of Arabs and Africans with a very special flavor. Mm. At the time of the British Empire, where the sun was not set on the empire, we had a Sudanese who called himself the Mahdi, and he drove the British outside Sudan in the fairest revolution of its kind. And this thing, we inherited it from our lost forefathers, and we continued. In 1964, we had a revolution against a military government.
Mm-hmm.
And we took them over. And then again, a military government came in, and in 1984, we did it again, and we pushed the military over. And then again, when the Bashir overdid it, the same thing came to the Sudanese again, and they said, if we did it three times, we can do it again. And actually, the people who were spearheading this revolution this now were people who were there between 18 and 30 years, and those are the people who were born and bred during the Bashir regime.
Mm.
And they were so angry at him that when the revolution was ignited, they were prepared to die for it. And this is why hundreds have died, and Bashir has tried to kill. Oh, they killed so many innocent youths for nothing, trying to put fear in them, but it didn't work. So this is one reason. The issue is that the Sudanese have been doing this.
Mm.
This is one reason. The second reason is the economic reason. Because of mismanagement, Sudan became very poor.
Mm.
Because it became very poor, there is no jobs, there is no money, there is no good education, there is nothing. So because of this economic, people tried to, actually people called it hunger riots.
Mm.
Because people were so hungry that they couldn't take it anymore. They said, why we will die of hunger, it is better we die with by standing, and they went into this revolution. The third reason is that many youths who tried to run away, they were unable to run away. Thousands of youths died in the Sahara Desert,
mm-hmm.
or died in Libya, where Libyans tried to put them in the war zone to defend the two warring parties in Libya. And those who did not die in the war or in the desert, they died in the Mediterranean.
Mm.
And so the remaining youth found that there is no need to run away. Let us stand our feet, and create a change. And there are three factors: the historical factor, the economic factor, and the practical factor that is happening in Sudan has given the revolution energy that has not died till now. Despite this the second military coup or the third military coup, the revolution is still standing. Today's marches in Sudan were the busiest of all the 2 years of revolution or 3 years of revolution.
So
the energy is still there, and I think it is going until you have democracy, until you have civilian rule.
Sure, and that's something that I want to touch on in just a few. But what I also want to know is, in terms of Sudan is a vast country, and as you mentioned, very many ethnic, racial, cultural, and to some extent, not to a large extent, but to some extent, religious influences, right? And one of the things that Umar al-Bashir's government was accused of was the division between what was regarded as Africans and Arabs within Sudan. I mean, how has, the Sudanese people been able to deal with that particular issue? Because one of the biggest allegations against Umar al-Bashir and his government was the fact that he was oppressing, black African people, and that Arab, people or people who were regarded as Arab were elevated within society. So how are you dealing with that as a nation in trying to obviously create some form of unity and put that stuff behind you?
You remind me of something that happened to me. In 1995, the African National Congress asked me to come and do a presentation about the problem of South Sudan. And I did a sort of an academic presentation about the problem of South Sudan, that it's very, very complex. It has historical reasons, it has ethnic, it has religious, it has economic, it has this and this and this. But anyway, the question that came from the floor was insisting that this was a problem between the black Africans and the white Arabs of Sudan. And next to me was sitting the Secretary of International Relations at that time. Her name is Maya Kayaka Manzini. And she is a fair color lady. Okay? So when they insisted that the problem is ethnic, African and Arab, I asked them, I put my arm next to her arm and said to them, who is more African now, you or Maya Kayaka Manzini? And one of them said, you are more African than her. I said to them, then I am the Arab of Sudan. My tribe is an Arabic tribe. Do you think I am Arab or I am African? So the Arabs of Sudan, to me, this is why I said in the beginning of this discussion that Sudanese are not Arabs. We are Arabized Africans. Okay? And we just took the religion, and we took the language, and we are African. Actually, we are African 100%. But our language is Arabic, and there is no difference between the Sudanese. They have intermarried between them, that it's very difficult to recognize who is an Arab and who is not an Arab. So this was not, for me, this wasn't the question. The other question of religion, Sudan is like South Africa. There is a lot of tolerance for religions at community level. At community level, there is a lot of tolerance. But when al-Bashir regime arrives, it actually, let me ask, not so al-Bashir, we have another military rule in 1964. They were very anti-Christian, and they refused to allow Christians to have churches. Okay? To give them a certificate. Of course, if you wanted to build a mosque or a church, you have to apply, and the municipality has to assign that a piece of land for that purpose. If it is a school or a prayer place or whatever. that military school were refusing to give Christians sites to build. So people have to make their own houses.
For
the same thing is happening with al-Bashir time. With al-Bashir time, the government will be sort of seen as anti-Christian or biased religiously. But the communities, the Sudanese themselves, they are very tolerant and they don't have that thing at all. They live together. This is why we are very happy about this democracy now and a civilian rule. Because under a civilian rule, we hope that all those ethnic divisions, all those religious divisions, and even economic divisions will be reduced to a very high degree because of the tolerance of the Sudanese, because now the jobs will be open for competition. So only those who are eligible will get the job. And people will feel that life is fair for them. This is what we are hoping for, and this is why we are insisting this revolution will continue and the military must go back to their barracks and let a civilian rule happen into that. And we hope that it will happen. We hope so.
So let's talk about the civilian rule situation within Sudan at the moment. I mean, obviously, this coup was led by, there was an uprise from society, from ordinary citizens, from civilians. But then obviously the military got involved, and I guess to a large extent, that is what obviously aided and made sure that this whole process was seen through to the end, right? But there was obviously, at least a couple of years ago, I can remember, once this uprising had occurred, And Omar al-Bashir was obviously deposed of power. There was, unfortunately, the situation that seemed to rear its ugly head, where there was these long, protracted negotiations between the government, not the government, but the civilian forces as well as the military forces. How far are we in that particular space? I mean, has this been settled? Is this now a civilian government that has taken over? Or is the military saying that, listen, we still like to be in charge?
Yes, you see, we found ourselves in a dilemma. You can't eat an elephant in one meal. So we said, let us get rid of al-Bashir and his immediate people who have been very bad to us, and we put them all in jail. And we said, let us take the second class Bashirs and work together with them until we have elections. The elections will bring civilian rule. But we never thought they will again do another coup. Of course, we as civilians, we don't have an mission. Our revolution is a peaceful revolution. And we said our peacefulness is our weapon. We sort of took a Mahatma Gandhi stance in resistance. And this is what has happened. People were very peaceful in their demonstrations. Whatever atrocities were done on them, they just took them chanting their chants. And they never reacted to them. And we feel this is going to protect our revolution until we get our civilian rule, where we hope that no one will use arms against. But to be very frank with you, the whole of Sudan is armed to the teeth during those 30 years. Just to mention that al-Bashir has created a whole new army because he was scared from the same army where he got his ranks. He was scared of them, so he created a completely new army of militia to protect him from the army. So I'm telling you that Sudan is full with ammunition. Actually, yesterday we had a big problem in Darfur where there is a tribal clash. And I'm telling you they have used all types of arms. I'm a medical doctor, so I don't know the names of the of those machines, but they said it was a real battle. All types of artillery was used in that, and people died. Villages were burnt down. So al-Bashir actually, although he is in prison, what he has done with his hands, he is still killing Sudanese all over Sudan. All over Sudan. So we have to work with the al-Bashir leftover of military to keep the peace until we have elections. But unfortunately, on the 25th of October this year, they had a military coup, and they put our prime minister and all our ministers and other civilians in jail. They killed more than 40 civilians who were going in the street peacefully, and they are still killing them even today. There are people who have been injured. And it is written on us that we have to leave the military until we have elections. And all we have is to have faith and hope that this time it will drag on until you have a civilian group, until you have elections.
But then the question for me is, I mean, how is it possible where you have a, you know, a heavy-handed military that doesn't want to give up power, a heavy-handed military that keeps on pushing, you know, to this particular point whereby, you know, they want to maintain power. I mean, the last time, at least there was some form of negotiations between, you know, the civilian leaders and the military leaders, just for there to be another military coup. So what are your chances of them being able to have a peaceful transition?
No, there are three things, there are three very strong things that we believe will take us to our elections and a civilian rule. One of them is the stance on the street. The streets are charged. And I don't think they will be discharged until we have elections. This is one. Two, the international community, I'm telling you, sometimes things happen at the right time for the right reason or the wrong reason, I don't know. The enmity between Europe and America, as between brackets, against China and Russia, between brackets, totalitarian regimes, has reached a peak this year. And we are benefiting from that. The Americans and the Europeans are 100% in support of that civilian and dissent in Sudan.
Sure.
So this is something that is also giving us some hope. But the third one is the coup plotters themselves are so unsure of themselves or are so ashamed of the number of people they have killed or whatever reason they have, they kept saying all the time, we are here to keep the peace until elections. We are here, we will go to our barracks after elections, and we will go after elections. So they kept saying this. None of them have said, we wanted to stay and rule this country because it has to be ruled by the military. So those three reasons, there is no appetite for the military to continue ruling the country. The support from America and Europe, and even the region, America has pushed Saudi Arabia, UAE, to sign an agreement that they will never go against the civilian rule in Sudan, although they are not democratic countries. It is going to the benefit of us. So we think this will keep Sudan on the right path to go to civilian rule.
I get you, and I hope that that is what ends up happening, you know, that there is that resolution eventually, because I think one of the biggest concerns, especially on the African continent, I'm sure, you know, history is our best template for that, is that, I mean, if we look at what happened in Zimbabwe, if we look at what happens in many other parts of the African continent, one thing about many of these leaders, military or civilian, once they have tasted power, they, you know, generally unwilling to hand over power or to hand power back. you know, to civilians, because they're in charge. You know, they have the military, they have the funds. Even if the funds are diminished, they still have, you know, the most money in the country, and all too often in the most power. So all too often they don't want to give that up, because even if they do give it up, they know that they have to ultimately surrender something, you know. And that for me is my biggest concern. So I really do hope that things do work out for the Sudanese in there from that perspective. What I wanted to touch on is, you know, your relationship, excuse me, as Sudan with South Sudan. I don't believe that there will be stability in the region if the two countries do not find a way to get along. The split was in an effort to try to stop, and we lost him. And the point that I wanted to make there was that the split was formed or caused because they wanted to obviously bring about some form of peace. But unfortunately, just splitting or creating a border between two countries is not necessarily going to bring about peace. So what I'd just like to know, what is the, you know, the backlash? What is the outcome? And how do we go about creating peace between the two nations? That's what I'd like to look at up next. And what are the implications if the ongoing tensions prevail between Sudan and South Sudan? Looking up at the time, it's 15 minutes to go before we get...
Walking this talk together.
Every hour.
Every day. This is 702.
Let's walk the talk.
14 minutes to go before we get to 10 o'clock. We still have Dr. Abdul Algoni on the, line. From the Sudan Solidarity Group, and he's the spokesperson there. Doctor, unfortunately, we lost you there for a little bit. But what I just wanted to know is, I mean, what steps are being taken at the moment for peace to be established, obviously, between, you know, yourselves as well as the South Sudanese?
Yes, actually, thank you for this question, because I want to remind you of three things that have happened.
Hmm.
One of them is that all the South Sudanese I meet them as brothers, and we feel that situation. And they meet us and they feel that situation.
Hmm.
This is one. Two, when we wanted to bring the rebel movement to peace with Sudan, it was the South Sudanese government that stood up and convinced all the rebel leaders and the movements to sign a peace agreement with the new government in Sudan. And that peace agreement was signed in Juba, the capital of South Sudan. This tells you how they are very keen to keep peace in South, in northern Sudan. And actually, President Salvador said many times that when peace is happening in northern Sudan, it will reflect itself in South Sudan and vice versa.
Mm.
So we know that the war has stopped, and actually Sudan also has played a role in the end of the enmity and the signing of a peace deal in southern Sudan, where now they have a unity government. So there is a mutual support between the two countries, because both of us feel that if a war in one country is practically a war in the other. And we believe if we can have a civilian government in the north of Sudan, it will immediately create a relationship with southern Sudan, where there will be no border between the two countries. People will move freely, everything. It's just like before South Sudan has seceded, although we will keep the two governments, the two systems continuing, but the people, as I told you in the beginning, is one nation. We will start having no borders between Sudan and South Sudan, the civilian government. And actually, this has been said by Dr. Abdullah Hamdok, the Prime Minister of Sudan, has been said by all the political parties in Sudan. This is part of their agenda for the elections, is that what they will do after the elections is to open the borders between North and South Sudan and have one country. with two governments. So there isn't any issue between the two. The issues between South and North Sudan is created by the military and the previous regime of Omar al-Bashir and the Muslim Brotherhood, who have a sort of Islamic agenda. This Islamic agenda is no longer there. The military will no longer be there if we have a civilian government. And we hope that we will live in peace ever after, if that thing happens.
It's very tragic, because ultimately what you're saying is that one man and the people that surrounded him, unfortunately led to this particular situation, all the way through to one country being split in two, and that split continues, and hopefully that there will be peace between the two nations. But I do echo your sentiments that if there is no peace in either one of the two countries, then you are going to constantly have ongoing conflict between the two nations, which is in itself a tragedy. I mean, what are living conditions like for people in Sudan at this particular stage? Because, you know, we look at, you know, various reports, and you look at various indices, whether they measure poverty, whether they measure stability, and all of those other things. The fact of the matter remains that Sudan always ranks amongst the lowest, and that there's always a worry and a concern about the circumstances that surround Sudanese people. So what is life like for people in Sudan at this particular stage? I mean, politics aside, are people able to survive? You know, are they able to meet their needs? Are they able to basically say that, listen, we're happy and we're able to eat bread and drink milk at the very minimum? Or are people struggling?
Well, let me be very frank with you. I don't want the Sudanese to hear me. There is no life. People are just living. But there is no life, and there are a number of things that shows you there is no life. People are just living. If they said every youth in Sudan, if you ask him, where do you want to be in the year 2023? They will say 95 of the Sudanese youth you ask, they will tell you, I wanted to be out of this country. Where? Because it doesn't matter. Anywhere other than this country is better than where I am now. This is what people are saying, because there is no life. And Bashir have destroyed and his regime have destroyed everything in the country, has destroyed the economy, has destroyed education, has destroyed the future of the youth, has created situations that are unlivable. I'm telling you, thousands of Sudanese youth have died in the Sahara Desert and in the Mediterranean. Just last week, a few Sudanese have died in the Mediterranean. I believe, if we follow the news today, the 30 migrants who died in the channel between France and UK, you will find the Sudanese among them. Because there is no life in Sudan. And this is why the youth who are staying in Sudan are very determined to create life in Sudan. And they say, let 1,000 of us die for the other millions to survive and have a life. And we will have no military rule in Sudan. And I think this is what is going to happen. We will hear it, that by 2 years from now, we will have our elections and we will have a civilian rule. And we believe the military have brought all those atrocities, have brought all those conditions that destroyed the Sudan, a very rich country that has been destroyed just by the greed of a few hundred Islamists and military generals.
Yeah, no, I hope that actually happens. I mean, what's happening on the socioeconomic level? I mean, what developments are happening in Sudan to try to alleviate that situation? Because I assume that there's a high level of unemployment. You have a lot of Sudan is a massive country. Part of it in the Sahara Desert. You have people who live a nomadic life. You have people who live, in small villages, in small, settlements. What is being done to try to help urbanize? Is there a plan to urbanize people? Are you leaving people to live sort of that pastoral slash, nomadic life? Well, what is the situation?
To be very frank with you, one of the reasons why today there are millions on the street is that they have seen the light at the end of the tunnel. Thanks to Dr. Abdullah Hamdok, our Prime Minister, and his team that is around him, in the last 2 years, there are a number of positive things that have happened in Sudan. One of them is that Sudan has been taken off the list of the countries that support terrorism. That was a sword that was standing on our head, and we can't get anything. I can't even send $100 to my family in Sudan from Johannesburg because I can't. Sudan was under the embargo. That was lifted, which is one thing. The second thing, we couldn't benefit from the relief of debt as one of the poor countries, as you have just mentioned now. Sudan is always in the bad part of the end list. So we couldn't benefit from that. But fortunately, our civilian government has paid money to the and paved the way for us to benefit from the relief of debt. And we have benefited. Now, at least billions of dollars has been given to Sudan that our government, for the first time in the history of Sudan, has, like South African social grants, have given social grants to almost 60% of the Sudanese. 30 million were given monthly financial support through the relief of the debt that has happened during this government. This is the second positive thing. The third positive thing is that the government said Sudan is an agricultural country and we have to focus on agriculture as our future hard currency. And they did, for example, they said last year the thousands of hectares of cotton production has not been in the history of Sudan. Millions of hectares. This year we will get millions out of agriculture. The size of land that was cultivated in the last agricultural season is the highest in the history of Sudan. Why? Because the government has put a lot of investment into agricultural infrastructure and made that possible. The other thing is the first time in the last 20 years we have $2.7 billion in the central bank that we are there sitting. All the other years we were always in deficit. And because of this $2.7 billion in the central bank, the Sudanese pound has stayed in its place for 6 months for the first time in the last 30 years. There are a number, if I can continue telling you the positives that have happened in the last 2 years, that the coup tried to kill, tried to destroy and take us back to where we started. And you might have read that America said there is $700 million that was supposed to be given to Sudan the beginning of this month, the beginning of November.
Yeah.
They are not giving that. Why? Because of the coup. So the coup actually has wanted to destroy the hope of the Sudanese youth.
And it's basically but taken you
so
back.
Many positive things.
Look,
and actually, we are very thankful to South Africa. It is good with the people of Sudan, yes.
Doctor, look, we'll have to end it there. I really do appreciate your time, and I wish you all the best, and I hope that Sudan then can return to civilian rule, that democracy then prevails, and that the military allow that to, you know, give that space, not allow it, but give the space for that to happen. All the best to you, and thank you for chatting to us this evening, okay?
Thank you very much, and please keep Sudan in the coming few months in the news, because we need your support for us until we cross this difficult time. Thank you very much, and I have a number of other colleagues in the Sudanese Solidarity Group who can join a discussion like this. Thank you very much. And
Only a pleasure. I'm sure we'll have that conversation again in future. That was Dr. Abdul Elghani. He is the Sudan Solidarity Group spokesperson.